Empowered presents Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show. From making your own cleaning products to composting, recycling, keeping chooks, and reducing your carbon footprint, Maureen and her guests will inspire you with practical, everyday solutions that make a difference. That's Eco Living in Action, Thursdays at 2:30 p.m. on Otago Access Radio. Proudly supported by the Dunedin City Council.
And welcome to Eco Living in Action, the sustainable living show that focuses on the everyday things that we can do to make a difference. I'm Maureen Howard, a sustainable living facilitator for the Dunedin community. Well, we've been having a wonderful summer, and it's easy to forget, perhaps during this time, that in the winter, many families struggle with cold, damp houses. And I'd say, you know, as a city, we're making progress with installation grants and so forth to upgrade our housing stock. And this is great. Now, overseas, especially in Germany and Scandinavia, there's a movement in housing design that takes warm, energy-efficient housing to a whole new level, where houses are capable of maintaining warm, stable indoor temperatures, even when the outdoor temperatures are well into their minus figures. And this is with very little extra heating required. It's called Passive House, and spell this P-A-S-S-I-V-H-A-U-S. Comes from Germany, and these high energy performance standards are achieved using a combination of super insulation, passive solar design, draft stop proofing, and heat recovery ventilation systems. And today, Tim Ross is joining me in the studio to chat about Passive House. Tim has a passion for low energy housing. He's a registered architect and a certified passive house designer here in Dunedin. He leads an architectural practice called Archetype Limited. Practices expertise in domestic renovations, new houses and community architecture, as well as significant experience in institutional and commercial clients, both in New Zealand and overseas. With Tim's experience in passive house design, his building business is able to specialise in low energy housing design. So welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Maureen.
So I was very interested when I met you. I guess it was about a month ago now, was it?
Yeah, it must
have
been, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was keen for you to come on the show. And, you know, you're an architect, but, you know, what's grabbed you in particular to get into passive house design?
Well, I guess it's probably a rather long story, but I think while I was studying, and many of my colleagues when I was studying would have had a passion for sustainable design, and possibly not really knowing how that was best achieved. You know, throughout my education, there were plenty of rooftop wind turbines and photovoltaic cells shown on buildings and things like that, but really no understanding of how to make a building fundamentally perform better and more efficiently. And so during my time working in the UK, I remember coming across the concepts of airtight construction and thermal bridge-free design and the idea of using ventilation systems so that you could get good air quality without opening all the windows. And I thought, wow, that sounds really, really good. Like it's a proper strategy for achieving these things rather than a piecemeal approach.
Mm.
And so years later, coming back to New Zealand, still finding that those things hadn't really been, I wasn't seeing those things happening in New Zealand, and seeing another colleague having done his passive house design certification training, I thought, you know, I think I'll do that and try and expand my knowledge in that whole area.
So it was a big learning experience, and you went over to Germany, did you, to do that?
No. The course was up in Auckland. It was a 3-week course followed by a pretty grueling external exam, which is marked in Germany. After that, you're then issued with your certificate of certified passive house designer. But the learning curve's huge.
That's
for sure. Yeah.
And you really need to have a lot of prior experience before you even sit it, don't you? You know, in terms of architecture.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of numbers to crunch there. It's a lot of quite building science-based, so, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. Now, you know, I just mentioned in the introduction some of the key features, so, you know, let's go into them. So the it's a design process, isn't it? It's not just something, as you said, it's not that you sort of add in here and there, but you really kind of start at the outset with this idea in mind, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to describe it to people that, you know, there's a bunch of key elements. Probably the most important element would be form and orientation. So right at the beginning of the design process, you need to get the building form right. Because if you, for instance, an H-shaped building would have a very high surface-to-volume ratio and mean that it's very hard to achieve these kind of standards without spending a huge amount of money. So if you try and default to a relatively compact building form, that's certainly better from a thermal point of view. I mean, obviously, as architects, there's lots of things we consider in the design process. There's site, there's views, there's, you know, creating outdoor spaces with the building. So those are all part of the mix. But our tendency is to try and, unless there's a really good justification for doing otherwise, go for a compact building form that faces north and catches a good amount of sunlight. Beyond that, there's the super insulation. A typical wall build-up in New Zealand would have an R value of about 1.8. Most people are familiar with the term R value. A passive house would in Dunedin would need to be about 3 times.
Wow.
That. So
okay.
More like 5 or 6 R value for the whole wall build-up. And that goes for the roof and floors as well. So you've got, very, very, very well insulated.
And you're looking at volume there, aren't you? Like, so it's like 3 times as deep, I guess, for the ceiling, perhaps.
Yeah, there's some expensive ways of doing it where you can get, you know, you can compress the volume, but generally the thermal conductivity of most insulation materials is about the same. So to get higher values, you kind of just have to increase the thickness,
mm-hmm.
unless you go with some pretty sophisticated options. So, yeah, you need to, to thicken that up.
And then draft proofing. Well, we know about this in Dunedin, you know, where we have a lot of drafty houses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably probably the biggest thing that we need to kind of get right here in New Zealand, because insulation people understand. Draft proofing, to an extent, people understand, but really coming up with a strategy which makes the whole building envelope draft proof is a bit of a learning curve. So the way we tend to achieve that is by using building elements which are inherently airtight, rather than, you know, stick construction. You know, when you're building with timber pieces of wood, you have to use a membrane to achieve an airtightness there. Whereas if you work with other options like structurally insulated panels or even block work, they're inherently airtight. And then you just have to be careful with the junctions of how those meet, say, the wall, the roof, or the floor. So you just really need to take a bit of care around how each of the different parts of the building join together and make sure that there's not, air gaps and air leaking through there. Because we're trying to achieve, for passive house, we're trying to achieve an air change rate, some technical numbers here, of 1.6 as a maximum air changes per hour when the house is pressurized. So
that means you're pumping air from the inside.
That's right. So we use a thing called a blower door. You fit that in the front door. You pressurize the house just to kind of see where the air comes in, and you want to have all of the air, or you want to retain most of the air. So over a period of an hour, you can only have a maximum of 0.6 of the air having moved out of the building. And that compares with a villa which would have, say, 20, you'd have 20 air changes in the same period of time, or a new build where you might have 5 or 10 air changes in that same hour.
So, you know, what about sick building? You know, like, you know, we hear about that in the media, how would you address that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's primarily caused by a shift in the way that we've decided to build buildings. In the past, people didn't have the expectations that their houses would be warm. They had a big chimney, and they sat around the fire, and the updraft of that chimney would actually cause a huge amount of air to change, and you'd have really good ventilation. You wouldn't get stuffy air building up inside. But the moment we start to put insulation into the walls, we create a warm, humid environment inside the house. We don't have that air, you know, rushing through all the time, and you end up having the moisture in the air ends up condensing on the cold surfaces of the inside of the house. So we all see that on our windows on a winter's morning. You see, the condensation forming on the coolest part. If it's the aluminium frame windows, it'll be on the aluminium. If you've got timber windows, it'll tend to be on the glass. And those kind of environments, and they can also happen in the corners of the buildings as well, but those kind of environments are really great for bacteria and fungi to grow, but you know, terrible places for humans to be.
Right. I was also thinking about materials, you know, materials that are used in the house and, you know, carpetings and, you know, furnishings and just things off-gassing from those materials.
Yeah, the whole issue of volatile organic compounds and things like that. Yeah, I mean, and you don't have that problem so much with a house with a ventilation system because you're constantly changing the air. So off-gassing that does occur is sort of flushed out of the building quicker.
Right, because that brings us, to that third point, which is the heat recovery with the ventilation system.
Yeah, so that's probably, once you've achieved the air tightness, if you achieve air tightness of around one air change per hour, you start to need to then bring in a ventilation system. Otherwise, you will get stuffy air when you don't have the windows open. So with Passive House, they tend to use a device or a product which is called ventilations with heat recovery. This is not what New Zealanders typically think of when we think of ventilation with heat recovery. We typically think of HRVs, fans sitting in the roof space, pushing air down into the building, pressurizing the house from the roof. It's not one of those at all. It's a far more sophisticated system where the stale air is taken from, the stale warm air from inside the house is taken out, it's run past the cold, fresh incoming air, and all the heat is transferred between the two. So you essentially retain all the heat, but you get all the fresh air.
Right. And that's done with a small motor, or like, how does that work?
Well, you have a heat recovery ventilation system, and the heart of that is the heat transfer system, which basically is a membrane, so that the air runs right next to each other, but doesn't actually come into contact.
But does it requires a bit of electricity to operate it?
I mean, there is a motor which powers that, and that usually, you know, sort of a 60-watt kind of motor.
Yeah. Okay. And I presume if the electricity goes off, there's some kind of backup system?
Well, the backup is you just open the windows like everyone else.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right, so you can open up the window if you really want to.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I always make the point of saying you can open the windows whenever you want to open the windows in a normal house. So on a sunny day, sure, open the windows. But in the middle of winter, you don't need to open the windows to get ventilation.
Right, okay, that's the key difference. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then I guess the final factor, which you kind of mentioned at the beginning, is just, you know, the design of the house, and I guess you're orienting it to gain maximum solar gain and things like that, isn't that right?
Well, that comes under the form and orientation factor right at the beginning. Although unlike passive solar design, which is very similarly named, passive solar design really relies on those heat gains being stored in the thermal mass of the floor slab. Passive House doesn't really rely so heavily on those. While it uses them when they're available, it relies on internal gains from within the house mostly. So if you have four or five consecutive cloudy days, you're still fine because you're not relying on direct sunlight to bring your house up to temperature. You're really just like, you know, someone wearing a nice warm jacket, and there's an internal gain and internal heating in there, and that's enough to keep you up to temperature.
Great. So in some ways, then the Passive House model, it's quite suited to places that are, you know, like Dunedin, that can be cloudy for a little while on it.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think you passive solar has a harder job coping with, you know, consecutive cloudy days, whereas Passive House theoretically can work even, you know, on the dark side of the green belt. You might just have to up your levels of insulation to achieve the performance you require.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, Germany, like in the winter, it gets really cold there, and they're able to maintain these passive houses with a nice temperature. Yeah. And there's standards, aren't there, that's a really key part of it as well, isn't it? You know, you've got these standards of the house has to be at 20 degrees, is that?
Yeah, well, that's a key fact that's worth mentioning, is that when we talk about passive house, we're always talking about trying to achieve 20 degrees internal temperature all year round. And there's some numbers that go along with that. You need to achieve that by spending no more than 15 kilowatts per square metre per annum. So you're sort of limited to the amount of heat that you can push into the house. And you're also limited in the peak loads. So on the coldest winter night, you're only allowed a maximum of 10 watts per square metre in your heating appliance. So those numbers have been really carefully selected, not, you know, very, very, after a lot of research, to achieve 90% reductions in heating costs and in energy consumption, and also because they allow the amount of air being moved, they allow you to remove your radiator system or your underfloor heating system and provide all the warm air just through the ventilation system. And that way, it's very much designed around the realities of making it economical for people.
Right, okay. Yeah, and when you mentioned that, you know, 15 kilowatt hours per square metre, you know, if you were to calculate that across a, you know, a 120 metre house, you know, you're looking at about 1,800 kilowatt hours for a house.
Per annum.
Per year, which is equivalent to about a cubic metre of firewood, burning that firewood across the year. But, you know, as you have pointed out, you know, it's across the whole year, and it's keeping the house warm day and night, you know, and when you're not in the house or you're there, so it's...
Yeah.
We wouldn't normally do it to that standard.
Yeah, I mean, I know in our house we live in an old villa and we go through about 6 cubic metres of firewood a year, but we certainly, you know, we pretty much heat in the evenings. The living area, and we don't, you know, heat a lot of the bedroom spaces are kind of heated when they're used. So... Yeah, the comparison needs to be made between keeping the whole house at 20 degrees. And I think it's important to understand the savings that are available there as well, because when you have a house which is heated so that the kids can be in the bedrooms all year round and they don't kind of all migrate to the living room, you don't actually need as big a house as you might have thought you needed.
That's right. And then you've get rid of that whole issue of condensation and mold and stuff, because, you know, that happens when we do have these fluctuations in air temperature. That's when you start getting the condensation.
Yeah, so, that's right, yeah.
So it evolves that whole issue. So, yeah. Well, it sounds great. And I guess once the house is built, you've got great cost savings.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some pretty impressive studies about the cost savings of passive house over the life of the building. You know, if you've got a building which has lasted for 50 years and providing these kind of energy savings, you know, you're definitely better increasing your mortgage a little bit initially, putting in the money, and it'll pay, you know, really good dividends over the entire life of the building.
Yeah. And having that, you know, the World Health Organization, they recommend 20 degrees in the kids' bedrooms now.
Yeah, pretty hard to achieve, you know, just with normal heating options, especially in drafty villas. But, you know, those kind of things also have benefits in terms of health outcomes and, sick days off from school and everything else.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, you said that the house would be a bit more expensive in the outset, but you perhaps can go for a smaller house because you can use the whole of the house all year round. Can you give us a general ball game, ball figure?
Well, I mean, probably it's helpful to look at recently in the last week, there was the South Pacific Passive House Conference in Auckland, and they had some awards given there for based on different categories. One of the categories was around the economy and the cost of building, and so they had some square metre rates. So I think some of the winning entries were around the $2,200 a square metre kind of area, which is certainly, I mean, people tend to talk about 2,000 a square metre as being a target for a normal house.
Yeah.
It's often pretty hard to achieve, especially if you have some marble bench tops or things like that in there. So we're not talking hugely beyond the cost of a normal house, especially if you, you know, are intelligent about the way that you go about it, and maybe don't have, you know, massive sliding doors and things like that, which can be relatively expensive if you go for high performance windows. And there's a few things that you can do just to kind of avoid some of those really big costs.
Right. Yeah. Good. Okay. And, you know, how does it compare with, you know, we've got some existing, you know, green energy efficient standards such as Green Star. How does it compare as a system with them?
It's a very focused standard, I think, is probably the best way of describing it. A Green Star is a system which tries to encourage people to improve the performance of their buildings and the sustainability of their buildings in a huge number of different ways, from low volatile, you know, organic compound paints and through rainwater collection, veggie gardens, how they're located, you know, photovoltaic cells on the roof. So it's really trying to go for the whole range of sustainable strategies. Passive House doesn't try and do that. There's no reason why you can't overlay some of those things on top of it, but it's particularly focused on the running costs of the house. You can choose to focus on the building fabric and go for a more natural kind of build, or you can go for a build which has more levels of plastic or artificial materials in it. But Passive House doesn't really have anything to say about that. It just is purely focused on energy efficiency.
That's really interesting because, I really love the idea of straw bale houses, and you were just saying, about the insulation and, just straight away you've got massive insulation with straw bales. So it could fit quite well as long as you've got a good seal.
There's some good passive house straw bale houses in the UK. I mean, they have some other benefits because they can kind of absorb a bit of moisture as well and then give it back to the space, so they help to control humidity. I mean, there's no... for me, I think that's what I quite like about it. It is a standard which can apply to a range of different building types. And it's not simply limited to houses either. There's plenty of examples of schools. There's a couple of high-rise buildings. It's really quite a broad standard in the sense of what it can apply to, but quite a narrow standard in terms of what it deals with.
And so you've been working on some buildings and stuff that have elements at least of the passive house design process.
Yeah, I mean, it's still really early days here in New Zealand. We have probably 6 or 7 passive houses that have been complete and certified, and so the industry's still kind of coming up to speed in terms of making products available and economical, and also in terms of getting professionals up to speed on what's involved. So while we have... we have a couple of jobs, home on the peninsula, which is going to be, we've applied the approach to super insulation, ventilation, good windows. Also one in the city here, which is just about to start on site. And the High Street co-housing project, which we're working on, is likely to be to the Passive House standard. And another house in Maori Hill, the clients are really keen to achieve it, so we're just now working to develop the specification for that.
That's great.
Yeah, so there's a bit going on.
And I keep an eye on the High Street co-housing initiative. I've had a guest in talking about that, so it's really interesting. So, we've been talking here about new buildings. Are there any way that you can kind of retrofit the passive house features into your building?
Yes. I mean, it's an area that I find really kind of interesting, especially in a city that's filled with so many old buildings. I think there are a few key things to consider when you look at retrofitting passive house features in a house, or any building for that matter. It's worth doing it when you're going to do a major renovation anyway. When you're opening the building up and you're replacing rot or dealing with the fabric of the building, it's good to combine it with something else. Otherwise, the economics are really not going to stack up. But if you are doing a major renovation and looking at replacing a bunch of things, the other thing to consider is your overall strategy. These sort of passive house features, they don't work very well in isolation. For instance, if you were to upgrade the windows in your building to, fantastic triple glazed timber windows, but the floor was still drafty, you've really haven't realised the benefit of those very airtight windows when the air is coming through the floor. But if you can, pull up the floor and put in, a membrane under there, as well as doing the windows, as well as some insulation, all of a sudden those benefits kind of accumulate, and the result can be fantastic. Mm. It's one of those things where you have to push far enough to get the results then become exponential after you push far enough.
Right, you need to kind of look at several elements at a time.
Yeah.
And now, we've got this radio show. There's other places where people can find out more about this as well, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few podcasts which I often direct clients to because they're kind of directed towards people looking to build, and also, and some material aimed at building practitioners. But so Homestyle Green is a show that's run by a podcast that's run by New Zealander Matthew Cutler-Welsh. great resource for interviews and things like that. And the other one is House Planning Help, which is a UK show, and they often touch on passive house in various ways. There's another guy, Elron Burrell, and he's a Kiwi working in England at the moment, and he has a fantastic blog about passive house and often refers to issues that are pertinent to Kiwi. So,
and obviously people can go to your website, so it's www.archetype.co.nz.
So archetype with an I, not an E.
Right, yeah. Okay. And if they want to get in touch with you, they can do it through the website.
Yeah,
Archetype.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Tim, for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks, Maureen.
Yeah, and my house is done, but I'll do my best to keep it warm in the winter. But thank you for listening to this program about passive house with my guest, Tim Ross. I'm Maureen Howard, and you've been listening to Eco Living in Action. If you'd like to listen to the show again, it'll be repeated on Monday at 8:30 in the morning, or you can download it as a podcast from the OAR website at oar.org.nz. And next week, talking about propagation in the permaculture orchard. So I'll catch you then. Thanks for listening.
And pokes. It's then that you'll see the chips and the sawdust fly. Keep them logs rolling, boys, down to the Milky Boys. Keep them logs rolling down, for we'll drive the crosscuts through just to show what we can do. We'll pave all the streets of London town. Keep them logs rolling, boys, down to the Milky Boys. just cut through just to show what